Good morning. Welcome to the Brookings Institution. My name is Jonathan Lawrence. I am a non-resident senior fellow here and a professor at Boston College. On behalf of Fiona Hill, director of the Center on the U.S. and Europe, and Strobe Talbot, president of Brookings, I'm very pleased to welcome you to the latest installment of the Transatlantic Dialogue on Terrorism. Our distinguished guest speaker today is Dr. Oliver Russ, of the Office of the European Union's Coordinator for Counterterrorism. He will speak today on the topic of coordinated counterterrorism policy, experiences, and possibilities for enhancing U.S.-European cooperation. We are also very fortunate that Daniel Byman of Brookings and Georgetown will serve as discussant for his remarks, and I will introduce them both in a moment. The Transatlantic Dialogue on Terrorism aims to deepen the strategic understanding between the U.S. and Europe on the transnational terrorist threat and its causes, as well as to expand opportunities to develop complementary counterterrorism policy. We are very grateful to the European Commission for the support that makes today's events possible. I'd also like to extend a particular thanks to Andy Moffitt, the CUSE's Assistant Director. The European Commission's encouragement of this crucial discussion is extraordinarily timely. Unfortunately, the challenges of radicalization and terrorism are still as topical today as they were when former CUSE Director Daniel Benjamin first launched the Transatlantic Dialogue on Terrorism 5 years ago. But both the nature of the threat of violence and the framework for transatlantic cooperation have changed dramatically. For much of the past decade, American observers often assumed that radicalization was a European phenomenon that we in the U.S. were mostly worried about by proxy. How could we help them to stem the threat emanating from their quarters in order to protect ourselves from another 9/11 or to help them avoid another 3/11 or 7/7? The homegrown terrorism threat was discussed mostly in this European context, whereas in the United States, we debated the ramifications for the visa waiver program or the exchange of passenger records. It was often assumed that the danger faced from the domestic populations of the U.S. and Europe differed strikingly. To be sure, there were major reforms of the way that U.S. intelligence agencies organize and share information with one another and with their European counterparts in the member states and at the EU level. And federal and local officials began working more closely with local communities to improve relations and familiarity with American Muslim communities. But for years, the occasional arrests of suspected terrorists holding U.S. passports seemed almost accidental. And in general, their hubris far outpaced their capacities. Even as the intelligence community became increasingly concerned with apparent connections in some immigrant communities here in the United States, our confidence in the integrating power of the American dream was unfazed for a number of reasons. Muslim Americans' upward mobility, our proud tradition of religious pluralism, our sincere belief in the successful model of a melting pot or stir fry or salad bowl. Many in the U.S. felt, if not immune, then at least safely ensconced. Our citizens, it was thought, would be wholesale resistant to any siren call of terrorist recruiters, thanks in part to educational and employment opportunities. And thus, our national debate focused more on the constitutional implications of our detainee policies or our judicial procedures, rather than on the potential for homegrown terrorism. How could we in the U.S. offer lessons to Europeans on living together peacefully? And in the meanwhile, how could we keep the bad apples with European passports at bay? Our self-confidence may have peaked with the election of Barack Obama, whose presence in the White House and reframing of U.S. foreign policy, it was hoped, would help reduce the spread of violent extremism. But today's meeting finds us somewhat chastened. All the while, instances of serious radicalization were, in fact, taking place within our own borders. Recent events and arrests in the past few months, few weeks, few days have offered ample proof that American citizens are not immune to religiously framed appeals to political violence. During the 8-year period since September 11th, the transatlantic relationship has experienced ups and downs, but intelligence sharing and interagency cooperation on counterterrorism always remained strong, even while U.S. and European leaders confronted one another in the U.N. Security Council or debated the wisdom of deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan and even used one another as straw men in election campaigns, a quiet, constructive working relationship endured and led to increased cooperation on police and judicial affairs and border control. Recently, we have seen the EU and individual member state assistance in facilitating the closure of Guantanamo Bay and in the ramping up of military and civilian support for the ISAF mission in Afghanistan. Now, American officials still hope for more support on these and other fronts, but in many ways, it would seem that the window of opportunity to enhance transatlantic coordination on counterterrorism has never been opened wider. According to recent polls, our citizens share similar perceptions of the terrorist threat. The American president's popularity in EU member states is off the charts. And in his major declarations from the inaugural to his addresses in Cairo and at the UN General Assembly, the president has heralded a new era of U.S. multilateralism. Under the leadership of the EU counterterrorism coordinator, there have also been many strides made on behalf of creating a single counterpart for U.S. authorities. Whatever cultural differences exist among America's 18 intelligence agencies, one can imagine that coordinating counterterrorism policy among the agencies of the European Union's 27 individual member states is perhaps an even greater challenge. We are very fortunate to have with us today two individuals who are well-placed to discuss the evolution of this strategic understanding. Dr. Oliver Russ is the advisor to the EU counterterrorism coordinator, Gilles de Kerchove, in the General Secretariat of the Council of the European Union. Before joining the office of EU CTC, Dr. Russ served as deputy head in the counterterrorism division of the German Federal Ministry of the Interior, where he mainly dealt with militant Islamism. Dr. Russ holds a doctorate in European law and constitutional law from the Freie Universität in Berlin. Our commentator, Daniel Beiman, is director of Georgetown Security Studies Program and the Center for Peace and Security Studies, as well as an associate professor in the School of Foreign Service. He is a senior fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy here at Brookings. Thank you, gentlemen, for your participation. We will first turn to Oliver Russ.
Yeah, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for the invitation. It's an honor for me to speak here on behalf of the EU counterterrorism coordinator. He's very sorry that he cannot join us today, but he sends his best regards for a fruitful discussion and a successful conference. And as you might know, he's very active also in the transatlantic arena. I think in the last 3 months, he was at least four times or five times in the United States to discuss CT issues here with several partners around. So thank you to the organizers, to the Brookings Institute. Of course, also we in the General Secretariat, we are following your activities very closely, and thanks to the European Commission, and we try to follow your activities even closer. So I'd like to address the following four questions. What is the current CT strategy within the European Union? Then second, the Lisbon Treaty, long discussed in a way, and now it came suddenly into force, some kind of surprise, and what has changed. Just to get you some ideas of the changes, we will have a more coherent foreign policy, better coordinated between internal aspects and external aspects of European policy, and I think and I hope that will be also make transatlantic cooperation much easier in the future. We are at a turning point in the EU at the moment. We will have a president now. We will have a new high representative for foreign affairs. We'll have a new commission with new portfolios and several other changes within the treaty that makes European policy also in the internal aspects, security aspects, but also in the foreign aspects much easier to handle in the future. So hopefully that will be a change, and I will like to speak about that later a bit. But we have to keep one thing in mind. Even though we have now a new treaty, president, etc., European Union is not a federal state. We are not a federal state, and special national security issues will remain in the in the competence of the member states. So by that, just because expectations sometimes run high with the Lisbon Treaty, especially outside the European Union, there I have to say that not that much has changed as somebody might have hoped. Yeah, as I said, we are in a turning point. So you could ask, is it maybe too early to discuss the further cooperation? Because the president just has to settle himself. The high representative has just taken office, etc. But I think it's still, and the introduction was said, it's a very good point to discuss also transatlantic cooperation in the CT area, because first of all, from a practitioner's perspective, from an academic perspective, we have to advise the new politicians what might be the best way to achieve common goals in the future. And also, we have already new guidelines for the EU, the Stockholm program on security-relevant policy was adopted last Friday by all heads of state of the European member states. So we have a very recent new program, and I hope that will also make cooperation easier. And so by that, we have already political guidelines for the future. The counterterrorism coordinator had issued on this also a discussion paper that I'd like to present to you briefly later on. What are the key challenges from his perspective on counterterrorism policy? And then finally, I'd like to draw, just to make some points, what might be open to discussion, where do we see possibilities for cooperation and common challenges, and just three points that might be of interest. For example, to in deepening parliamentary cooperation, the role of the Congress and the Senate in the United States, I think it's often underestimated from a European perspective. We only look on the government as a player. And now we have in the European Parliament, with the European Parliament, also a very powerful and active player that will also be relevant for CT issues. So this might be one issue we could talk about later. Another one is the growing sense of CT fatigue all around public in Europe, but maybe also in the United States. I would be very interested to learn more about this, because this CT fatigue, of course, it is a security risk. And another one is that violent extremists are watching our measures, of course. They are learning to hide better, to communicate different, some behave in a way, wolves in sheep's clothing, I would say, using more legal ways of propaganda while preparing the worst things in secret. So these will be the aspects I'd like to draw your attention on. What is the current CT strategy in Europe? I'd like to start maybe with a short look on our view on the threat, the terrorist threat in from a European perspective. Of course, Islamist terrorism remains the most significant source of threat to the Western world. Whatever organizational dislocation Al-Qaeda has suffered, propaganda especially remains very powerful to inspire, especially young individuals, and you have learned it now also in the United States, to get involved into terrorism, to go to other countries to involve in terrorist training. And also weak states like, for example, Sahel or Yemen, they remain a very severe threat to our societies to be a safe haven for terrorist organizations. And finally, also the Internet, I just mentioned homegrown terrorism, is a very important tool for radicalization and recruitment. So some examples of the last arrest, for example, or attacks in Europe in the last 3 months. We had, for example, an attack on an army barrack in Milan in Italy, where a typical homegrown terrorist blew himself up at the gate of some barracks. Then we had the arrests here in the United States that were linked also with a plot to attack maybe the Danish newspaper that has published the cartoons of the Prophet Mohammed. And we had also something very worrying, I would say, that French police arrested in the beginning of October a scientist from the CERN Institute, that's a nuclear scientific facility in Switzerland. And this scientist, later on, he confessed that he has spied and contacted Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. So he had close links to a core Al-Qaeda-affiliated organization. And that's something, of course, what worries us in the European Union. So the number of verdicts also was stable in the last years. We had 198 verdicts in 2007 and 2008, 190, a very high number. That is also a sign of the persistent threat. What are the four pillars of the EU counter-terrorism strategy? We have, like in many other countries and many other institutions, the area of prevention, protect, pursue, and respond. In these four pillars, we are very active, and I'd like to draw your attention more on the aspect of prevent. First, of course, in the European Union, we always have to ask, why do we have to do it in Europe on a European level? Why not in the member states? And just to answer this question, I'd like to refer on opinion polls, and the fight against terrorism is one of the key areas in which, according to some surveys, European citizens see a need for a common European response. 81% wish more European activity in the fight against terrorism, and I think that's a very extraordinary high number compared to other issues. So I start with the work stream on prevention. We have a lot of projects there. As I said, we have the European roof, I would say, and under this there are the different member states active in counterterrorism politics. And we used this division of labor in a way to say several member states take project leads on projects where they are most interested in. And, for example, the United Kingdom initiated a work stream on media communication and strategic communication in the area of prevention. For example, they set up a network of communicators, upgraded the institution's proactive engagement with Arabic media. They established a network of researchers and a web portal to improve media and strategic communication in the area of prevention. Another project is imam training that was taken over by Spain, and it's the idea to first map all the imam training activities in the different member states and later on to make an assessment of the needs to improve training of imams, not to, in a way, give way to preachers of hate, but to have a better controlled and better organized system of imam training where you have moderate voices as imams. Then community policing, for example, is a very important issue where Belgium draws attention to, or the Netherlands have worked a lot with local authorities, and we never have to forget that the local level is the most important level for city activities. Of course, we can make some strategic decisions, we can pass some laws, etc., but when we come to concrete prevention, it's the local level that is the important area where we have to improve our politics and where we also have to support people working on the ground, I would say. And I just would like to mention some groups of people active there, welfare workers, teachers, of course, youth workers, and also prison staff or district managers, minority organizations. And the idea of the Netherlands is to give them tools to handle prevention and de-radicalization in a better and easier way. Another thing that might be also of interest for you, and it's an example of a quite, I think, new way of transparency, is that Denmark is now engaged in a disengagement, de-radicalization, particularly for young people. And what is very special in this project is that openly the Danish Security and Intelligence Service is involved in this project, and I think that's something quite new, because normally intelligence agencies are working more behind. They don't like to show their involvement, and this time they declared publicly to also participate in such a project. Another thing, as I have mentioned, the Internet and the role of the Internet for radicalization and recruitment already, is the Check the Web project, also a European project, and I'm very happy that a colleague from Germany that has done a lot of effort in this is today also attending this conference. So in case you might have, I can't see you at the moment, in the last row. If someone has some questions on this project, she might be able to answer your questions in the break. And this project is about burden and labor sharing in the area of monitoring Islamist activities in the web. and to say so that we have many different member states active in this, and if you have a more, I would say, integrated approach upon this, a more coordinated approach, you can, of course, achieve much more by not everyone monitoring the same sites, doing the same work over and over again. Something else, now I came to the second pillar of protection, is that we have put a lot of effort into the area of security of explosives. For example, there was a big conference in this autumn where also some colleagues from you, from United States, took part, and they agreed that European Union there is in the lead, and that maybe you also can learn a lot of, from this project that is very advanced, the implementation of an action plan. And finally, also some new development. It's now in the area of response. We just have adopted a CBRN action plan for the European Union. It was just adopted by the Council of Justice and Home Affairs Ministers. And there, Europe now has got an integrated approach to counter the very important and severe aspect of CBRN threat. And finally, in foreign policy, we have the so-called stability instruments that I think are also a very important aspect for transatlantic cooperation. That means the activities of the European Union in, for example, weak states, in developing states where we have now money and a lot of money also to invest in security-related field of counterterrorism. Yeah, this is the current strategy, and now some remarks on the Lisbon Treaty and the new changes. So you are, in a way, seeing now a new Europe with a new treaty laying behind and other competences, et cetera, et cetera. And, yeah, we also have to get used to this new treaty within the European Union because despite of 8 years of discussion, it came quite of a sudden, as I said. Last week we had just an anecdote, the foreign ministers were quite shocked that suddenly they were not members of the European summit anymore. They have discussed the treaty, they have negotiated the treaty, and by accident they have negotiated themselves out, and then later on they realized that in the text they agreed they were not mentioned, and so they weren't part of the European summit anymore. And I think we will have some other surprises that will arrive in the near future. But to come to the maybe more or better effects of it, we will have now not three different areas of European cooperation. In former times, what is it, the integrated policy, then we had a foreign defense policy, and we had the area of intergovernmental cooperation on justice and police. And now everything is combined in one, one treaty, in one policy, and that makes, coherent policy much easier, and in a way we have put together under the European roof all three pillars, and not now the roof didn't fall down, but we have more solid walls and hopefully no gaps in between where terrorists can sneak through, I would say. Yeah, what are some other changes? We have now a solidarity clause in the treaty where states, member states, in case of a major terrorist attack, help each other. We will have a new external action service that will represent the foreign policy of the European Union all around the world. And also this is another step forward to have a more integrated and one streamlined European policy, even though that will take, I think, some time just to get the common spirit, the common identity. And finally, but last but not least, of course, we will have a president now of the European Union. It won't be a president like you have in the United States giving Europe his direction, but hopefully it will be a president that gives Europe one direction. And I think that's also a very big step forward. So you will have someone that in the old process we had in former times with different member states taking over presidency, etc. We have now one person giving Europe one direction and taking up the initiatives, the ideas of all the 27 member states and bringing it into one line, into one move forward. And I think that's a very big step forward, even though maybe from your perspective from the United States it's still something that, of course, is not on the same level like you have here, but I think it's a very good step forward, and we will have a high representative, and, of course, we will still have a counterterrorism coordinator that, again, was stated he will continue the cooperation in counterterrorism issues internally, but also in the field of foreign relations. I have already mentioned the Stockholm program. The Stockholm program is the over several years, the program what European Union and member states will be active in security policy and also in counterterrorism politics. And here it was again stressed in this program that is very important in the whole fight against terrorism to respect for the fundamental rights, of course. It calls for a reinforcement of the prevention strand to develop mechanisms, in particular to allow early detection of signs of radicalization or threats, including the threat from violent militant Islam. Then also it calls to improve initiatives to counter radicalizations in all vulnerable populations, and calls that more has to be done in understanding the methods used for dissemination of terrorist propaganda, including the Internet. And finally, it also draws the attention on the area of charitable organizations. So terrorist finance through charitable organizations will one field of activity for the European Union in the last years. So now you saw we have a new framework with the treaties. We have a new Stockholm program on city issues. And now we also will have, in the beginning of January, an upcoming Spanish presidency. So even though we have a president and a high representative, we will still have all the different member states having presidencies in the European Union. So it's a way, a mixture. As I said, we are not a federal state, so member states are still very important in the EU arena. And so in a way we combined the continuity of a president, of a high representative, with the idea to bring in member states, bringing in new ideas, bringing in their identity, their energy into the system of rotating presidencies. And this year it will be the Spanish presidency. So if you like Sun and CT, Spain will be the right place to be in the next year. And the priorities of the Spanish presidency will be to enhance the cooperation between national counterterrorism centers, to establish their informal structures, also to focus more on radicalization and prevention. And also they will develop an internal security strategy for the EU. So much to the background. And now, I will tell you something about the key challenges from the perspective of the counterterrorism coordinator. So he issued a discussion paper. It was discussed in the with the Justice and Home Affairs ministers of the EU of all 27 member states. And we had also, the paper was given to the European Summit to all heads of state last Friday. So it's also quite recent discussion, and we are looking forward to get input and responses on all the ideas in this paper. One thing is to focus more on victims. Victims need more support. The victims of terrorism are the victims of an attack directed to the society as a whole. And therefore, society has to show solidarity and recognition and support. But it's also very important to look more on the victims of terrorism, to delegitimize and to de-glamorize terrorist activities. And I think that's also something very important when we look on city fatigue and on the discussion on human rights issues, that we easily forget the victims of terrorism, and there are many. Another point he made was to intensify and broaden prevent work, of course, cross-cultural dialogue, etc., and to work more on local communities. Another aspect is development and security, including the European security and defense policy, and that we have to work more on failing and failed states that might provide potential havens for terrorist organizations on all other sides of crime. And we have to combine better our policy in security and also the development process, development policy to handle this problem. Another aspect he proposed to the ministers is to look again on the legal framework to handle terrorist activities. And, for example, the aspect of participation is a very important one. We have in Europe some member states where participation in terrorist activities or visiting a terrorist training camp is already a crime. But there are others where it isn't, where you don't have a legal framework for this, and it is a very difficult thing to get the right legislation to handle this this problem, and I think you might have the same problems with now your citizens arrested in Pakistan that wanted to join a terrorist training camp. It's a very difficult issue in case the people haven't done anything yet. They might not be affiliated to any terrorist organization, so they haven't done anything, so can you convict them? That's a very important question. And we have to keep in mind that a clear, fair, and undiscriminating legal framework that is accepted by a vast majority of the population, also maybe some relevant migration communities, is essential to prevent radicalization. Then we also want to focus more on soft targets like transport system, of course, and also on hotels. I started a dialogue with some international hotel chains because hotels are a key target for terrorist organizations. We want to look more on critical infrastructure and cyberspace because cyberspace, being very important for our modern societies, is a very relevant arena also for terrorist activities. And to handle this, we want to focus more on public-private partnership because many infrastructures, etc., are handled and organized and in the ownership of private partners, and therefore the EU has begun a dialogue between public and private entities in the city area, for example, with ISP, internet service providers, to come up with new ways of cooperation to take down illegal content in the internet. And finally, was the idea to put more on security-related research. So by that, the key challenges from the counterterrorism coordinator's perspective. So now to the discussion, what might be some possibilities for cooperation and what might be some common challenges. As I have mentioned in the beginning, city fatigue is from my point of view, a very important issue. We have to avoid mistakes from the past by relaxing our guard. We could put ourselves in the pre-9/11 thinking and thus enabling a repetition of history, and that we have to prevent. Another aspect countering city fatigue, as I mentioned already, is victims' voices and counter-radicalization will be one item for the Spanish presidency also. And also to have a good cooperation and dialogue, of course, with the United States based on common principles and values, like it was stated in several EU-US joint statements from this year. The second thing is to examine similar challenges in prevent activities. I just want to mention the trend of travel activities. Young Westerners continue or are increasingly traveling to conflict zones such as Afghanistan and Pakistan border area or increasingly to Somalia in order to train there as terrorists and to join Al-Qaeda. So we have to discuss this issue and to be in a close exchange about this development. We have to explore more the relation between diaspora communities and conflict zones, for example, Pakistan and Somalia. And we have to continue the dialogue on how we can counter radical violent contact in the internet. And by all of that, I think we would achieve something what I would call understand radicalization better, explain radicalization better, and by that prevent radicalization better. There might be some possibilities of a change on the EU counter-radicalization projects. We have also a radicalization and recruitment action plan already decided in 2005 with a lot of practices already finished or ongoing. And only when we, with better understanding of the whole process of radicalization, we can create a better understanding in the press, in the public, and also for our decision makers and hopefully decision takers. And then we have the chance to continue our policy to address the future challenges and get the backing we need to continue our up to now successful counterterrorism policy in the European Union. Thank you very much.
Good morning, and thank you all very much for your patience in listening to my remarks. The job of the discussant, I think, is both to be brief and to be provocative. I will try to be both and hopefully succeed at least in one of those two. What I want to talk about very briefly are problems that I see within Europe in counterterrorism and also American problems in counterterrorism cooperation dealing with Europe. Many of these problems are known. A number of them are longstanding. But I think given the tremendous change organizationally and legally that is going on in Europe, it's worth bringing some of these up again in the context of our discussion today. One of the biggest challenges from a counterterrorism point of view in Europe, I believe, is that it's easier for a terrorist to be European than it is for a government to be European. And if you think about this, one of the great successes to me of European integration is the mobility of individuals across Europe. And this is something quite impressive and to me historically amazing. But at the same time, while individuals can move, police and intelligence officials cannot. Legal codes are different. As is well known, it is exceptionally difficult in the United States to get different parts of the same bureaucracy to talk to each other. It's even more difficult to get different bureaucracies in the United States to talk to each other. And when you then say those bureaucracies should be talking to foreign partners, you're talking one level of challenge beyond. In Europe, this is the same. At times, in a number of countries, actually much, much worse. I mean, historically, you've had cases where, you know, French intelligence has been investigating itself, where parts of French intelligence have investigated and cooperated with foreign governments against other parts of French intelligence. So when you then take this bureaucratic rivalry and animosity and bring it at a cross-national level or at a supranational level, it's exceptionally difficult. So the problem is we've enabled, if you will, a relatively small number of, technical term, bad guys here, a relatively small number of bad guys to be much more effective in a European sense. But the barriers are still there for people who are fighting terrorists. A related problem is a lowest common denominator sort of problem, which is if you think about counterterrorism, now the thing that most people focus on, and understandably so, are the shooters, are people who have guns, are planting bombs, and so on. But so much of effective counterterrorism actually has very little to do with them. A lot has to do with the logistics network. So you go after people who recruit, you go after people who provide false documents, you go after people who do training. But in Europe, you have very different laws by country on these issues. A number of the laws still focus primarily on the shooters. And as a result, individuals can do the logistics. They can do some of the recruitment and even to a certain degree some of the training in one country and then operate in another. So a country's own vigilance, I don't want to say is irrelevant, but a country's own vigilance is limited by the actions of their neighbors because you can have one European neighbor acting in a way that affects the security of another. This lowest common denominator problem, though, is natural and to me must be a huge problem for European officials because I think European states face quite different problems. There is a certainly kind of a nature of the problem in the sense of whether it's the Pakistani community in the United Kingdom or the North African community in France. But beyond that, there are a number of member states that, in my opinion, face very little terrorism challenge. And as a result, a policy that has to go across the entire union has to square those that face a rather severe problem and a rather minor one, is to be exceptionally difficult and is going to face problems. Not surprisingly, we see huge issues within Europe, huge differences within Europe, I should say, on, to me, a core question when it comes to radicalization, which is government attitudes and societal attitudes towards first, second, third generation Muslim communities. And here to use the word Europe is exceptionally misleading. I think there's far more variation within Europe than there is variation between Europe and, say, the United States. That if you look at the United Kingdom, the Netherlands, and France, for example, you have very different ends of a spectrum, with the French in particular being quite coercive on these issues. As I'm a professor over at Georgetown as well as a scholar here at Brookings, and from a professor's point of view, that's a wonderful thing because we have this thing called variation and we can study it and look at what works. I think from a counterterrorism point of view, though, it's quite dangerous and disastrous because inevitably you're going to have some significant failures in this area. And these differences, again, are going to affect the neighbors of those that are doing more sensible policy. The U.S. problems with Europe, in my view, stem from a number of these issues. One of the biggest ones is that, as was pointed out briefly in the introduction when the visa waiver program was mentioned, that from the United States' point of view, probably the most dangerous terrorists are Europeans. In part, this is because of easy access to the United States through the visa waiver program. But it's much more than that, in my opinion. If you take, there's been a lot of focus on the madrasas in Pakistan. And if you take those, if you look at the average graduate of that, that person is illiterate. He or she has barely left their village. The idea that they are going to hop on an airplane, travel to Washington or New York, stay there for 9 months, scout the area out, acquire explosives, function in advanced Western society is completely unrealistic to me. That person can pick up an AK-47 and go fight in Afghanistan, but in terms of sophisticated counterterrorism, we're not going to see it. And the plots that have been disrupted since 9/11 in Europe show that, show a very different personality, show individuals who are quite well educated, very at home with functioning in Western society. And yes, of course, those individuals could come to Washington or New York or another American city and function quite effectively. So the level of danger to me is much higher. And I think there's a bit, if you look at, to me, the two most dangerous near misses in terms of attacks on the United States, Richard Reid, the shoe bomber, and the August 2006 planes operation that was disrupted in the United Kingdom. Both of those were attacks on the United States from Europe. The logistics, the work was all done in Europe. And the goal was to use that network to then launch an attack on the United States. And to me suggests both the danger and the limits of some of European counterterrorism if that is a logical approach for doing a mass casualty attack on the United States. A second issue, and related again, is the dangers of the failures of European integration on the safety of the United States. Now, let me be clear. The United States is hardly perfect on this, and I'll single out American problems with the Somali American community as a case where, in general, the American, Arab American and non-Somali Muslim American communities are exceptionally well integrated. But the Somali American community is not. But in Europe, this is a much broader problem. It encompasses vast communities in several European countries. And if you look at failures, if you look at the hostility, I'll mention here very briefly the recent vote in Switzerland about the minarets. From an American point of view, these problems are not domestic European problems. These problems are American security problems. And they're ones that America, of course, can do relatively little about. I can't imagine the President of the United States or the Secretary of State going to Switzerland and advising on a referendum. But nevertheless, the United States has to deal with the consequences of this. And given the danger of the individuals, potential danger, I should say, that's quite troubling. A third critique, and this is probably common on both sides of the ocean, is that there's a sense that many of the European states are much better at criticizing than at helping. And if you look at the dispute about Guantanamo, this is the case where I think there was, for years, tremendous, often legitimate criticism about the U.S. policies in Guantanamo. But then when there was a decision actually late in the Bush administration, and then continued much more forcefully in the Obama administration to try to close this, there was a sense that actually Europe was part of the problem. You know, there were European requests for guarantees that these individuals would not return to terrorism before accepting them, which, of course, was the last thing the United States was ever going to do because the United States believed a number of these people probably would return to terrorism. And so there was a sense that Europe is, you know, well, I'll say Europe is somewhat like a professor, which is the joy is I can criticize, but I actually don't have to deal with the problem and implement a solution. And there was a sense that Europe was in this. And if you look at Afghanistan, certainly there have been some small increases in the European troop presence in Afghanistan. But I will stress the word small. I will stress a number of countries have made their contribution relatively clear on making sure they will not be fighting. And so while it's certainly nice to have a number of these countries present, it's nice to have multiple flags at coalition headquarters, in terms of actually solving the problem, in terms of going after a very serious issue, there's a sense that most European states are actually not fully committed to this. And this, to me, is a critique on both sides, which is I think the United States sees counterterrorism primarily as a foreign policy problem. And as I mentioned, I think that's a bit misguided because a lot of what the United States should be concerned about is domestic policy. And something like the 2006 decision in the United States to openly side with Ethiopia in its invasion of Somalia, that foreign policy decision had tremendous domestic consequences with the Somali American community. But the European problem is the reverse, I think, which is when I think many Europeans think about terrorism, they think about subway bombings. They're not thinking about foreign policy decisions. And what I tend to focus on in particular is Pakistan, which is, to me, Pakistan is the nexus of so many dangerous problems beyond counterterrorism. But if you look at, and if you look at a fair number of the plots in Europe that have come up since 9/11, they've been traced back to Pakistan. And I applaud the idea of more focus on the internet and new means of recruiting, but of far more importance to terrorist organizations is having a sanctuary from which to operate, having a place for their leadership to have a sanctuary, having the ability to train, to organize on a large scale. And terrorist organizations have that now in Pakistan, and it's getting significantly worse. We've seen a dramatic increase in the problem in the last 3 or 4 years. Yet I don't get the sense, to my surprise, that the European states see Pakistan as the problem that I believe they should. And with regard to Pakistan, I think there's been a lot of focus on development when in terms of the kind of European foreign policy towards counterterrorism. And in my view, that's a mistake. Development to me has benefits, a wide range of benefits, well beyond counterterrorism. But for counterterrorism, I rarely see it as a benefit. I see it as simply there. At times it can make things better. At times it can even make things worse. But it's a nice thing. It sounds good to say we're going to raise people's standard of living, therefore they won't shoot people, when I actually see relatively little evidence for that, and I can go on in great depth about that proposition if you want in Q&A. But the irony is there are some bureaucratic weaknesses the United States has where it would be wonderful if the Europeans stepped up. In particular, there are two odd things about the American federal structure. One is that we don't have a paramilitary force that's nationwide. So we don't have a gendarme, and a number of European states do. The other and related point is, while we do have an FBI with intelligence duties, we don't have a domestic intelligence service in the European tradition. We don't have a Ministry of Interior that does intelligence rather than does parks. And as a result, when two of the most important things the United States can do in its foreign policy in helping other countries fight terrorism, which also helps the United States, is to develop their domestic intelligence services and to develop their paramilitary capabilities, not their military capabilities. The United States has superb military training missions, but what they often do is train people to be relatively cheap light infantry. And that's not what counterterrorism, that's not what you do in counterterrorism in terms of, or low-level counterinsurgency. You want a very different sort of officer. And I do believe the U.S. military has been trying to learn these skills, but these are things a number of European states already have, that already know from their own experience. And from an intelligence point of view, from a paramilitary point of view, it would be tremendously valuable to have them more engaged and have these programs expanded, rather than have the United States do them in, to me, a very limited and at times weak way. Let me conclude there and simply say I'm very glad we're having this discussion because, to me, there's a natural commonality of interest between the United States and Europe. And so a lot of the question is getting both sides to focus on the needs of the other, the problems of the other, and ideally working together on the solutions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'd like to give Dr. Hust the opportunity to respond to a couple of Dan Byman's points, and then I will turn to the audience to solicit some more comments and questions for either of the speakers. Dr. Hust?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, some of the aspects, especially addressing the European Union, I think, are part of the problem that, first of all, the European Union, especially some member states, don't see themselves or didn't see themselves as a global player in the way the U.S. sees themselves. And I think there's a lot of debate going on now. There's when you look, for example, on Germany and the whole discussion on Afghanistan, there's a very, tremendous, not tremendous, how do you say, a very... quick development and discussion and a very, yeah, just let's follow it. I mean, it's very interesting. But in general, I think that's maybe the problem that might be a little bit better with the Lisbon Treaty, but we will have the nation states being responsible for something. We'll have the EU, and in between, the more operative it gets and the more concrete action has to be taken outside, it will still be difficult for the European Union. I think we have done a lot of this to make Europe move forward, to have a single voice, to have a better organizational structure to work on this. And I think we have achieved a lot, but I think more has to be done, and there's the U.S., a natural partner to discuss this issue. So far from my side.
And if I could just follow up on one of Dan Byman's points regarding religious restriction, restrictions on religious freedom in various European countries. You worked for a number of years at the German Federal Ministry of the Interior, which together with other agencies in Germany looks very closely at distinctions among Islamist groups, including those who approve of violence, those who support the use of violence, those who are prone to violence themselves. In a number of German Länder as well, you have had restrictions on the wearing of headscarves. This has obviously been a recurrent theme in French politics, now with a parliamentary commission reviewing a ban on the burqa. Of course, Switzerland is well outside your purview. But can you envision any European role in this area of religious freedom? Do you see it as being relevant to this discussion on counterterrorism? Or is this something that, like with the questions of national security that you mentioned at the outset, will simply remain in the realm of national prerogative?
A good question. It's a very delicate issue between the also from the tradition of the different member states. When you look on, for example, Poland, and I remember the discussion before the Lisbon Treaty was discussed, a European constitution or constitutional treaty, and there was the aspect in it if God shall be mentioned in the preface, and that was a heavy discussion between several member states. For example, I think between France and Poland, for example, and so I think it will be quite difficult to find one line on an EU level on this. But I think, nevertheless, there are very interesting projects and ways to deal with this issue on European level that might be interesting also for the United States. I mean, for example, as you have mentioned, the example of Germany, where you can forbid, for example, organizations that are promoting violent politics and a way to overthrow the constitutional order. And that's something where I think this is an example where you can learn from, to have a very clear procedure to deal with violent extremists and the propaganda activities and all the organizational aspects in behind. So, but that's more on national level, and I think on national level you can have very interesting examples, but to have a European approach on this in the near future, I can't see this. It's too much about identities also. So, and there are 27 identities,
right,
or even more.
Okay, I'd like to open the discussion to the floor. We will pass a microphone to the first questioner down on the left. Please state your name and affiliation before asking your question.
Diana Negroponte from the Brookings Institution. My question is for Dr. Roos. How do you draw the Brits closer into your coordination? They have a special relationship with Washington on intelligence sharing, and they have a predominantly Pakistan community with Commonwealth passports, which permits nearly open transfer between the two countries.
To answer your question first, I'm from the General Secretariat, so we are serving the member states. It's a very political question, but just maybe this is an answer that, first of all, the UK now has the high representative and the person that is responsible for foreign policy. And also a lot of colleagues, especially in the security and the CT area, arena around me, they are UK citizens. So they are very active in this field. And maybe, yeah, just often it's also interesting to look on the real work and practical engagement in this area compared also maybe to the public announcements. So, but it's a very political question, so it's difficult for me to answer. I'm very sorry.
Yes, sir.
excuse me, Judd Herriot, documentary filmmaker. I'd like to address a question to Professor Weimann. You raised the issue of a national gendarmerie or a paramilitary force like the Europeans have. How would such a thing work here?
Here in the United States, yes.
The
United States doesn't have one, and in a way, never needed one. I mean, the U.S. military for a long time, you know, if you want to go back 150 years ago, had a kind of low-level war function. So there's no need to create one for U.S. domestic problems. But if you think about a number of countries that have a counterterrorism problem around the world, what they're often facing is a low-level insurgency. And it's an insurgent group that is linked to terrorism, involved in terrorism, but also does guerrilla tactics at different levels. And to do that, you need very different kinds of military forces than what you need to fight conventional wars. And so what you want are things such as low-level infantry that focus in part as police. You want police units that can be the equivalent of kind of highly mobile and, you know, almost, you know, the jargon would be heavier units where they have more capabilities and are able to fight a more sustained battle that reinforce locals. You want a very high degree of intelligence sharing. And this is something that traditionally police are not trained to do. You know, if you think about police in the United States, they're not trained to put information in a central database and ensure that's available to other police members in all 50 states. In fact, the opposite. There is a legitimate and appropriate focus on privacy. But that's because the privacy focus is there for domestic law enforcement reasons, not for intelligence and counterterrorism reasons. So I'm skeptical the United States could create one. I'm skeptical the United States should create one. But the fact is several European states, Spain and Italy, to single them out, already have this in part because they dealt with various domestic issues this way. And since they have this tradition in place, it would be quite relevant, I think, to a number of foreign states and should be used appropriately.
The gentleman on the left.
Yes. It's Howard Clark from Blackwatch Global. I have a question for both Mr. Roos and for Professor Weimann. Professor Bami, you talked a little bit about how development specifically in Pakistan, how there is a disparity or there's a lack of a connection between development and radicalization prevention and also safe haven prevention. And also I was wondering if you and Mr. Roos could also talk on a little more about the evidence on the link between integration or lack of integration of immigrant communities and terrorism and radicalization. It certainly seems like at least with a lot of the terrorist attacks that have played most highly in the press in Europe and the United States, and including the folks who went over to Somalia, that it really wasn't at least one could argue, especially in the second wave of the Somalis that went over to Mogadishu in southern Somalia, that it wasn't an integration problem. It wasn't certainly a poverty problem. It wasn't a problem of these folks, these kids, lacking the ability of upward mobility in Minneapolis. So I was wondering if you could speak on that a little bit.
Dr. Ross?
To be honest, I didn't get the question clearly, but...
The first question regarded safe havens and the second...
Okay. The evidence between development and preventing safe havens, and then the second question is evidence between the integration of immigrant communities and preventing radicalization.
Okay, concerning the first thing, of course, at the moment when you don't have any kind of governmental control in some areas, for example, in North Mali or in some areas of Pakistan, then it's the problem of safe havens. So what kind of ways to address this in development policy is something very difficult, of course. But, I mean, the lack of state control and of functioning governmental organizations that can enter several areas, also Somalia, etc., I think is quite obvious. So, Concerning the second question, maybe it's quite, you can't just say it's a lack of integration when you come to radicalization and recruitment. That's true. It's one aspect. There are several other aspects in the whole area. And when we look on some people that radicalized and on their beta, on their the whole way how they developed and their terrorist career in a way, I think there are several several factors that have an impact, and it's not only problems in the integration policy, but it's one factor that you can influence apart from the personal effects first. And second, I think, and that's maybe the reason why you are facing it now more in the United States, it's the identity thing. And Europe, with a longer tradition in also migration from Muslim countries, now is in the third or fourth generation in some areas, whereas I think for many or the majority of your population, it's in the second generation. And what we realized in the last years is that often radicalization is something what is more in the second, third generation and not so much in the first generations that entered into a country, because the identity challenge or the identity problem seems to be bigger in the following generations that are somewhere between their former state, and the country where they have been born, where they went to school, where they stayed all their life. And that's, I think, something more research has to put in, to done on. But
would you like to have a crack at that?
Sure. Let me focus on the second part about the integration evidence for violence. I tend to kind of turn that issue on its head, where one thing you can look at is the idea of, do poorly integrated individuals turn to terrorism? That, to me, the evidence to me is conflicting from what I can tell. The easier question to me is, does integration help counterterrorism? And there the answer to me is clearly yes. You have, just think notionally, if you have a community that is well integrated, that works closely with law enforcement, that sees law enforcement as friendly, then suspicious behavior and problems are going to be identified earlier, and it's easier for authorities to act. If the opposite is true, if the community is hostile to government, then even if there are individuals that the community doesn't welcome and want, it's much less likely to turn to the police or intelligence services to give that information away. And in an odd way, there's very good news on this. I don't want to read too much into the recent reports about the five individuals who traveled to Pakistan, because there's a general rule, which is the first reports are always wrong. So let me break that rule and assume they are correct. One thing that came out is the reason this came to the FBI's attention is because the local families contacted a Muslim American organization, which contacted the FBI. That's what you want. That's how the system's supposed to work, when local organizations realize there may be a problem and reach out to authorities. If these organizations had poor relations with the authorities, it'd be a very different situation and a much more dangerous one.
Gentleman in the front here.
Hi, Richard Gooding, Dutch Embassy. I have two questions, one for Oliver Russ. The question being, we have seen now almost 9 years of European anti-terrorism, counter-terrorism policy. How safe are the European citizens now compared to, say, 8 years ago? And how concerned should U.S. citizens still be of European terrorists coming to the U.S.? That's one question. And the other question is for Professor Bayman. We've recently seen the reports in the newspapers of these Virginia students that were arrested in Pakistan. Doesn't that defy your theory of a well-integrated Muslim community? And is it in fact so that the U.S. is now facing the same problems as with the radical Muslims as Europe has had for many years? Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, starting with your question concerning how safe are European citizens, how safe are U.S. citizens in this field, I mean, there's we have achieved a lot, and I think Europe in the last years has done a lot to improve their capabilities in a coordinated and a cooperative approach on CT. I just note from my member state background that there's a lot of cooperation also on the bilateral level, but also on the international level between all the member states, also in the intelligence community. That is was a huge step forward. And by that, I would say there's a lot of things have been done to make Europe safer and to make tourists from all around the world safer in Europe. There's a high awareness on the problem, on the threat in the European Union. But nevertheless, I mean, you know it from the States, you know it all around the world, terrorists, you can never get them all. You can never say it's safe now. So safety or security in this area is something where you can't get a clear answer. But just, I would say, Europe is well prepared.
Again, just to emphasize how little we know at this point about those five individuals, but assuming initial press reporting is true, to a degree, of course, anytime you have a potential move towards violence, it challenges the idea of a well-integrated community. So, yes, it certainly does counter that. The reasons I'm still a bit more optimistic on this, one is, as I mentioned, that the broader community was willing to work with authorities, which to me is quite different from some of the reporting we've seen out of the United Kingdom, for example, where we saw deep, deep hostility towards the broader, non-Muslim community among significant segments of the Pakistani community in the United Kingdom. So that's one bit of brighter news. The other is that these individuals didn't seem able to tap into a network in the United States. One thing that is very dangerous, and you see, I think, in many European countries, is that when you have an individual who's radicalized, he can reach out to a recruiter who effectively brings him to the next step, who says, okay, you're an angry young man, now you're going to go to Pakistan for further religious training, and has contacts there and puts them on a conveyor belt. If you look at what the initial press reporting suggests about the five individuals, they were kind of wandering around Pakistan saying, hey, would you train us for jihad? And while eventually someone's going to say yes, that's of concern, I don't want to minimize that, that's quite different than having someone meet them at the airport and take them directly to the tribal area. So it suggests a certain level of, or certain limits, if you will, to the domestic networks in place. But that said, yes, it does certainly suggest that some of the confidence about the integration of the American Muslim community may be overstated.
Now, one of the main obstacles to cooperation between the U.S. and Europe to bring this theme back into the discussion has been this assumption that the Americans use this war metaphor and that the Europeans use the law enforcement approach. The second great obstacle has been agreeing on the criterion for what constitutes a legitimate charitable group versus what constitutes legitimate political activity. Do you see, at least in those two arenas, and I would invite either of you to respond to this, any significant progress on at least these two cleavages?
I would say, of course, the idea of law enforcement versus war is, I think, a little bit too easy. I mean, but I think Europe has learned a lot also now in the Afghanistan engagement, that law enforcement is not the only way or not the first tool that can be applicated when you come in an area where you have something like insurgencies and real war against European soldiers, and that's something where you might have also in public a little bit of a problem with the public perception of the work Europe and European soldiers have done in Afghanistan, that it was more that European public, I think, thought that it's more or only about development policy and that it's not on using military means, and that's something Europeans have to get more used to, that also European soldiers are in combat, that European soldiers are getting behind terrorists and everything, but that's a process. But I think the process is working right now, and the debate and the discussion and the cooperation with the United States has changed a lot in the last years. So I think there's a lot of things both sides, I think, have approached in this area looking on the importance of law enforcement, of trials, of that area. So having a judicial aspect on it, whereas also Europeans have learned more on how to work in such an arena, what is not like working in Paris or London by two policemen knocking on a door and entering, of course. So I think a lot has changed in the last years, if this answers your question.
I'll try to tackle the charity issue a little bit. The irony is, if you went 30 years back, this would be the other way around, where there were tremendous British complaints, for example, that U.S. citizens were actively aiding the Provisional IRA through a number of charities that in reality were not helping widows and orphans, but were directly or indirectly funneling money to shooters. And that's, of course, a problem with charities, is you can have Hamas runs real hospitals in Gaza. And, a huge part of its budget does go towards social services. But these social services also aid the group's military wing directly and indirectly in a variety of ways. And it's almost impossible to tease out, with a particular dollar, how much of it is going to what, because there's so much bleed over between the two. And so in the end, I think it's less an analytic question and much more a political one. In the United States, the Hamas and Hezbollah's efforts against Israel are widely seen as illegitimate terrorism. And in Europe, they're widely seen as a legitimate struggle against oppression. And from there, I think you have the views on charities. So it's much less to be about charities and much more about the nature of the struggle.
I'm going to take one last lightning round of questions from these four individuals. Please keep it very brief so that we can allow the participants to wrap up, starting in the front and going back. And we'll gather the questions.
I'm Brian Beery, reporter for Europolitics. Mr. Roos, I'm wondering, are you happy with the current way that data is flowing between the US and Europe, specifically with things like the SWIFT agreement, where Europe is basically outsourcing the job of finding terrorist data because it doesn't want to breach its own data privacy rules, so it lets the US Treasury subpoena SWIFT, and then the US Treasury tips off Europe, and I'm just wondering if you feel that that model is a good model.
Thank you. Next question.
Is there a threat from a domestic terrorism threat in the U.S. from non-immigrant groups, by which I mean the far right, the militias, the groups that seem to be feeling very much alienated from American politics right now with the election of Barack Obama?
There was a third.
Gönül Tol from the Middle East Institute, and I have a question to Dr. Paimon. The radicalization processes show considerable variation among different EU countries. And my question is, can state-society relations or the place of religion in public sphere be a variable in this radicalization process? Thank you.
And a final question from the back row, please.
Thank you. Just a couple of few remarks to the presentation by Professor Beimann and a question that stems from that. I'll be brief, yeah. I was a bit surprised. I thought I would attend a meeting on enhancing U.S.-European cooperation, and then I felt to find myself in a meeting on American advice on European counterterrorism policy. I think there's a lot that can be said to what you criticized at the European level. I think there are very similar problems on the American continent. But instead of finger-pointing or doing the blame game, I'd like to actually hear where you see areas of cooperation and how that could function and where we could learn from each other instead of expecting the other to be like oneself.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask Dan Beimann to respond first and then allow Dr. Roos the final word.
Let me take the last question statement first. Yes, I was, of course, finger pointing. And that to me is actually part of the point of these exercises, which is to air differences, to air criticisms, to air grievances, because when you're within the chambers of government, it's very, very hard to kind of step out and talk about some of the deeper, more fundamental problems. That's just the nature of the beast. And so to me, part of the purpose of these outside exercises is both to remind people who are doing heroic duty, I would say, trying to improve the situation, that there are still deep problems. And for individuals who are futures, if you will, in the audience, I see a number of young people who I suspect will be working on these issues professionally, for them to be thinking about these so when they go into government, they'll be thinking about solutions as well as the problems. And in general, I say, I think actually pointing out problems is an exceptionally important service. And it's something that, you know, yes, of course, we should also be focused on solutions, but you need to understand the problem. And I think there's been this immediate jump in a number of cases towards the minutia of bureaucratic reform without very serious looks at the nature of the problem. And this is something on both sides of the Atlantic, certainly, but I will strongly defend the importance of this sort of thing. I actually did try to point out areas of mutual cooperation. So I stressed the idea that the Europeans have a lot to offer when it comes to training intelligence, because the Europeans have a much more robust domestic intelligence capability than the United States does. I'll add that I mentioned paramilitary as well. There's a broader issue when it comes to coordinated policy towards Pakistan. One thing Pakistan is very, very good at doing is doing the least it can get away with in terms of avoiding international pressure. If the United States and Europe speak as one voice, that's exceptionally powerful. And that coordination is difficult for certainly within Europe, and also difficult within Europe and with the United States, but when it can be done, extremely powerful. I mentioned Afghanistan. Here's something where I do feel I would like the Europeans to do more. I know the domestic political difficulties in most European states towards this. But when we say counterterrorism is a tremendous problem, and then we neglect something like a gaping wound like Afghanistan, to me that's a huge, huge dissonance that creeps into the conversation. One thing I'll add as well to the first question, which to me is very interesting, on the domestic threat from non-Muslim groups. Certainly. Absolutely. There's good and bad news in my judgment. I think these groups are energized in a very negative way by the election of Barack Obama. Of course, the first African-American president right there is an affront to a number of the truly crazy groups. And then even beyond that, a number of his policies, or I would say perceptions of his policies, he's very internationalist. He's someone who is perceived as being in favor of issues like gun control. So even for the groups that are not outright energized by outright racism, there's a concern about his policies as well. So yes, I think that's a tremendous concern. These groups, I think, are getting stronger. And when their concerns are kind of whipped up, that's something I would watch. However, I do think the FBI is paying tremendous attention to these groups. And for the most part, they've been a very limited professional competence. These are groups that have some skilled and dangerous individuals in them. But in terms of their ability to organize on a mass scale, I believe the FBI has successfully gone after these groups since Timothy McVeigh and the militia issues in the mid-1990s. So I have hope for the good guys, if you will, even though I'm very concerned about the bad guys.
If I could just stop you there, since we are running over time. I'm sorry.
No,
let me allow Dr. Roos to have the final word.
Okay, just short, briefly on the question concerning SWIFT and data protection. That was something where the coordinator was very much in favor of an agreement of going further in all the, as well on the data protection as well as on tracking finance, terrorist financing. And just to maybe to sum it up briefly, I mean, I think the discussion today was very productive, seeing that maybe to explaining you that we won't be a European state, you being aware that you can't ask us for things that only a European state could do, and for us also mentioning all the activities we have done in the prevention area where we are quite successful, that is also a aspect, was a colleague said, concerning internal domestic intelligence, but also in a broader local activities. And for you, just more, I would say, to look on the harder policy issues. And I think if we are cooperating there and listening more to each other, then we're on a quite good way in transatlantic cooperation.
Please join me in thanking Dr. Oliver Roos and Daniel Beinem.